Welcome to the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
My name is Sylvia Brownrigg. I'm a writer and reviewer living in Berkeley, and I'm incredibly pleased to welcome our guest today, Emer McBride. Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Okay. I'm going to introduce our guest, Emer McBride. Before I do that, I'm going to acknowledge our sponsor for this session, which is Culture Ireland. So thank you to Culture Ireland for sponsoring this panel. It's really a great honor to be here, and I'm very excited to be speaking with Emer McBride with all of you today. I'm going to give a brief introduction to Emer and her work, and then we'll start off with a short reading so you have a sense of her remarkable voice. Emer was born in 1976, I think in Liverpool, but grew up in the west of Ireland, studied drama in London. Her novel, A Girl is a Half-Formed Thing, was published in 2013 after a number of years receiving rejections before she found the publisher for it. It tells the story of a young woman's childhood and coming of age, her relationship with her family, an older brother who survived a childhood brain tumor and remains impaired in some ways, and a rather frantically religious and intermittently hostile mother, and an uncle who takes it upon himself to relieve her of her virginity when she's 13 in her kitchen. It's a very extraordinarily powerful novel, was a finalist for several prizes in the United Kingdom and won the Goldsmiths Prize and also the Bailey's Women's Prize for Fiction, which is a double header that was also achieved by Ali Smith. I was interested to read a writer who has sometimes been likened to Emer. Her newer novel, The Lesser Bohemians, was published in 2016 and won the James Tate Black Prize. Jeanette Winterson, reviewing The Lesser Bohemians, has a description of Emer's work that I think is fitting and helps set up her incredible voice for you. I want to make this conversation accessible to people who know Emer's work and to those who are new to it. Winterson wrote, "The airborne contagion of advertising and spin, political lying and celebrity froth makes authentic discourse difficult, makes reading the real thing difficult." She wrote this in October of 2016, actually, before our election here. Emer McBride's first novel, A Girl is a Half-Formed Thing, focused the reader on the words, disordered, rumpled, real. This was language that caught your eye and stared back at you. Reading it was an act of translation from a language known and not. We had to work with the writer to get the knack of it. It was a relief of concentration. Here was writing that reminded the brain why it has developed language centers. I have so many questions and thoughts to ask and to share with you. I'd love you to start, if you wouldn't mind, by reading a section. And please welcome Emer McBride.
Thank you. Hello, everyone. So I'm going to read a bit from The Lesser Bohemians. All you need to know at this point is an 18-year-old Irish girl goes to London in 1994 to go to drama school and very keenly to lose her virginity, which she manages with a much older actor who she meets in a bar in Camden. It's all very awkward, and they part ways and don't think they're going to see each other again, but now they have run into each other on the South Bank at the theatre. Up to the walkway under a hulkish sky, breeze licked and nerves cracking fissures inside as he points out, "Big Ben, Parliament there. Look through the grating." At halfway, he says, "Here's London spread out for you." In the murk, cold Thames still curling away, lights just beginning across the city, all the stone world of it, its stone face, showing its towers and flanks and shapes, purplish in this light and grey. And I stand, strick by its great space, watching the boats till St. Paul's there, he says, the Oxo Tower, Barbican, pointing out places I cannot see then can, because he stands behind. Look along my arm. No, there, no, there. Do you see? When I still don't, he bends to see it how I see, and I see all of it then. This is the most beautiful view I've ever seen, I say. Really? Better than Naples with those boats stretched out across the bay. Oh, fuck. He remembers my lies. Sorry, those are all lies, I say. I've never been there, or anywhere else. His elbow on the rail. Well, you're a surprise. What did you make all that up for? I don't know, to be interesting, I suppose. How very calculating, he laughs, and I thought you believed in love. I do, but love isn't what that was. True, he says, but what if I'd been a lonely soul looking for it? Are you? No, I'm not. And you're not much of a liar, I guessed. This, I concede, I've never been. Ah, well, that means you're probably quite good at the acting. I quick look up to see if he's joking. He's only watching, though. And in a moment says, so, you just used me for your sexual gratification, then? Well, I say, it didn't turn out to be that gratifying, so perhaps I got what I deserved. Didn't you get what you wanted? Didn't you, I say? Well, sort of. It started out well enough. You were hurting me, I whisper. You were a virgin, he whispers back. I'm not responsible for the laws of nature. Well, I know that, but I thought at least I wouldn't have to see you again. Ah, well, shouldn't have shagged an actor then. But by now, he is laughing, and I almost am, over my chasing brain. So throw my breath to the Thames and the strange of the day as we strangers stand looking out on the city. Quiet then, but for its sound, that noise it must make for its life to go round. Slow aftershave smell of some passing man, loud of the train as it clanks behind, me watching the river, him watching me. What? I ask. You know well what, he says, and stoops and kisses me. Fresh inclination and the blood goes up, bends me like a body, puts inside into my mouth, and we, deep and open, where is no mistake, where are only runs of thoughts of next, of kissing him in that short past naked, and he stops, I stumble forward, in perfect dazed unfurl, his breath on my hot cheek, then kissing me further, and I might fall over, but he has my arm, and we kiss like he drags me live from under the Thames, and where was all this want when I needed it? Oh, I don't care, I don't, and I could, enough, he says. This is getting ridiculous now. Do you fancy getting something to eat? There now, legs, but disgraceful knees. All his impulses working inside out too, it seems. For even as I nod, see him almost go again for me, and I am all for that. But he turns instead, wiping his mouth on his hand, leaving me tapping the prickle of mine to trail him over the bridge.
That's a great section to read because it really conveys the intense eroticism in the writing and also the banter between these lovers who are 20 years apart in age and also the very vivid textures of London. It's a great novel for London lovers because the textures of northern of London come alive. I wanted to go back and forth between the two works, and one of the first elements of Emer's writing you encounter is this remarkable language, and I just wondered if you could speak a bit about that. The two novels are different. I think the first novel has perhaps more, even more of a fractured syntax in its construction in this story of this girl, but that's common to both of the works, and I just wondered if you could talk about your arriving at that voice and that use of language to tell your stories in both books.
Well, when I sat down to write Girl is a Half-Formed Thing, I really had no idea what I was doing. And I didn't come from a university background. I hadn't done creative writing, so I didn't really know how you went about writing a novel. But I had been to drama school, and so what I did know was how you make a person. And that was what I was interested in, was people, really. And And the school I had been to was like a very hardcore Stanislavski method school. And so it was really about how you recreate the internal life and everything that you need to draw into that moment to make it real. So, you know, that it's not just about what the character is saying and how they're reacting, but also, you know, what's creating an urgency. Is there, you know, is their back itchy? And are they feeling self-conscious about what they've just said while they're answering again? And all of those things all happen at one time. And it seems to me that, you know, linear grammatical language works so much more slowly than the brain can, and that in order to make the language catch up to those create that immediacy, you need to break it up a lot more. And so Girl is also, you know, it's a book about trauma, and it's about trying to put the reader inside the body of this girl in the moment of trauma, so that they're not standing outside, they're not judging, they're not looking at her and thinking about her decisions, but merely experiencing, hopefully, what's going on as it's going on. And that kind of made the language a lot more broken. And so then when I came to Lesser Bohemians, and there is, you know, there is a big connection between the books and the girl in Lesser Bohemians dreams about the girl from A Girl as a Half-Worn Thing. But this was a book about someone who had got to the life beyond, and how do you live in the life after trauma. So it's really a book about survival. And so the language then, because it was not just about this internal focus, was about exploring this relationship. And so the language had to go out and be able to make connections. And so the book starts in a much more fractured way, much more like Girl. But as it progresses, it kind of connects up more and more, really to express that ability of someone. Girl can never get outside of herself and become part of the world, whereas in The Lesser Bohemian, she does strive to come outside and connect and become part of the world, and the language connects her up.
That's interesting also, because there's a character in The Lesser Bohemians who's at a later stage in recovering from trauma, and he has access to a more complete narrative ability. He can tell his story, I mean, with breaks, but without this fragmentation you describe. Purely coincidentally, I was on a panel a couple of days ago with a writer named Melissa Benyales, who said that recovery from abuse, this is relevant to her work as well, she said recovery from abuse is not linear, and of course that immediately brought your work to mind, that the girl in A Girl as a Half-Formed Thing is still, as you say, in the process of reconstructing her world. As you're the author of the book, as the author, I read some interesting material about you just kind of exploring what's possible in English because of your own use of and familiarity with other languages. That in there are moments in A Girl where you feel that Emer is really testing what can be done with English and maybe breaking it into its elements in a way that maybe is related to other languages you've either spoken. I know you lived in St. Petersburg.
Well, a little bit. And, you know, I speak lots of bits of other languages, but none of them well, because I'm, you know, interested to a certain point and then stop being interested when it requires hard work. But, you know, I did German at school and I was very interested in the way, you know, they just create these giant compound nouns and you can make it very, really specific. And I find with English is so blunt. It's quite hard to get to exactly what it is you want. And so sometimes you just have to break it up in order to get it to mean what you want. And sometimes you have to go around the direct meaning and sort of describe everything that the person is looking at when something terrible is happening to them, to give the impression of what is happening to them rather than physically describing that.
I think that's why we feel so inside her world, and that we learn how to see the world as she is seeing it, or as she's trying to construct the world. There's some other interesting choices that you make, in both novels, though in slightly different ways. The narrator of a girl is never named, and there are names of the characters in The Lesser Bohemians, but we hardly hear them. And it's interesting when you talk about creating a character as an actor and building a person up that way, because some writers, I would include myself in this, become very attached to the process of naming their characters and can even fetishize the process of naming your characters. And this is clearly not how you create these people. They're very powerful voices. Yeah. But can you just talk a little bit about that decision?
Well, I think with When I started with Girl, I hadn't really intended for her not to be named, but as the book progressed, I understood that's what would happen. And that was really about trying to break down the barrier between the character and the reader. Because what I wanted was for me as the writer to be invisible, for the reader to never feel like they're being directed around, told what to look at, told what to think, merely that this is something that happens between them and the character. And so it seemed obvious that if you want to create that very tight bond, you take away the markers of difference. Mm-hmm. And so although the book is set in Ireland and it's, the 1980s, and that's inescapable, you're not told when it is or where it is. You're not told what her name is. And sometimes you get a burst of how old she is just to, to set you in her life. That was really because, if I say, I'm Mary and I drive red Cortina and I live in Ballyvari, you immediately know that you are not Mary and you don't drive red Cortina, you live in Ballyvari. And that sets you away from that character. This is different. This is other. And I didn't want that. I wanted this to be, this could be me and I can understand this. Maybe I can understand this, this thing. And so, good to know.
That's a more specific geography than in your book.
That's the next book.
Yeah. Set on Center Street.
So then with The Lesser Bohemians, I started again with that same point that the reader to feel close to her. Because you follow the narrative through her and through her body and through everything that happens to her until you get to a point where he tells a story and then that's something different. But it seemed to me that the characters had to earn their way out of that loss of self, mm-hmm. that they had to go through a process of becoming, because, a girl is a half-formed thing. A woman is not a half-formed thing.
Yeah, that's right.
And the whole book is about her trying to get to that point and not really being able to become fully formed. And so this is sort of takes up where that leaves off, and it's also about that becoming, and they kind of get there, but they have to earn it, and mm-hmm. both of them only say the other's name when they kind of say the thing that is hardest for them to say.
Yes, it's a beautiful build to that moment. You do make the decision in this book, as we were talking about last night, to be specific, more specific about London and place and street names and that sort of thing. But can you explain why they are lesser Bohemians rather than greater?
Well, I think I really wanted to write about that London. I think London is the third character in the novel, definitely. And I wanted to write about that London that I had known in 1994 when I went to London to go to drama school. And I decided early on that I would make it, because, there are so many difficult things in the book. There are complications in the relationship and within the people, that I wanted to provide a kind of a ballast, mm-hmm. and a ballast of, I don't know, I suppose of reality in a way. So I decided that I would really very autobiographically recreate the London that I remembered, mm-hmm. and that I would sort of do the opposite of what Joyce did with Dublin. He said if it was destroyed, you could rebuild it stone by stone from Ulysses. And if London was destroyed tomorrow and they rebuilt Camden Town from The Lesser Bohemians, it would be the London that I remembered. And I really wanted it to be that and to be filled with that. And because also it was a book about love, I wanted it to be full of things that I love. And so so there are lots of, books and plays and records and things. But the reason it's Lesser Bohemians is because Camden, obviously, in that time was very strongly identified with lots of whacked out rock stars and pop stars and the Brit pop and everything. And they were kind of the greater Bohemians. Everyone chased them. Everyone knew them. They were sort of the glamorous set of Camden. But underneath that layer, there was other people who were living lives in which they were struggling to live with some kind of artistic integrity, to try and live a life that they believed in, that they felt was meaningful, that nobody was thanking them for, that nobody cared about, that they had to scrape an existence together to support. And I wanted to be clear that the book was about those, those Bohemians, rather than the sort of the glamorous ones.
So I thought I would talk for just a minute or two about redemption.
It's coming.
Yeah. Oh, good. Here in America, where we're very big on our redemption narratives in politics or sports. When we were watching the Winter Olympics, my kids and I were noticing how every sports narrative, every athlete had the opportunity for redemption.
Yeah.
So really all you have to do here anyway is have a really good, you know, downhill ski run and and you're good. But I'm just wondering, your characters move through trauma, as we've discussed, and other issues also, grief and love and sex. And I'm wondering if you would use that word to describe the transitions that they go through, or if you would avoid it.
I would absolutely avoid it. Mm-hmm. I'm against redemption.
You heard it here. You heard it here.
Well, you know what? Terrible things happen to people, and sometimes it's not all right. Yeah. Most of the time, it's not all right. Right. And it just is. A terrible thing just is, and that lives in the center of your life, and you just have to work around it, or you are destroyed by it. And you don't necessarily come out the other side of it. I think with Girl is a Half-Formed Thing, it obviously ends on a bit of a low note, but for me, the point of the book is the process. It's not the end point. And what I love about that character, what's really important to me about her, is that she goes through many really terrible experiences, but she is always trying to make herself. Mm-hmm. She is always trying to be in control, to make choices, to make decisions. And the problem is the society that she grows up in, the vocabulary that's available to her with which to describe her experiences is so condemnatory, is so religious, is so negative, that there is no way she can think about herself except as a soiled and right. destroyed person. There is no way outside of that idea of herself. And yet she struggles, and yet she goes. And although she makes lots of choices that actually end up just making the situation much, much worse, what I love about her is the fact that she doesn't lie down and take it and give in. And that at the end of the book, even though it's a bit depressing,
only a bit.
There's a sort of a. It's about transcendence, though, because it's about decision, about making a choice that is hers to make, and the way in which she can feel most whole within herself is to make this choice, and I like that about her.
Yeah.
I think with Lesser Bohemians, it's I don't know. Again, I think. It's a happier book in some ways, and it ends on a more positive note, but it also ends in complication. I think it's not clear-cut. It's problematic at the end, and problematic for them, and probably problematic for the reader as well. I think redemption is not interesting.
Yeah. There's a beautiful line. There are different ways you describe the characters going through their painful experiences. There's a particularly horrifying element of family abuse in the Lesser Bohemians. But and the character says about himself, "Everything soft in me slowly turned to bone," which I think is a beautiful way to describe that process. I wanted to wait for a little while into the conversation to talk about the publishing saga, but I wanted to spend a few minutes on it because you can't really read a reference to Emer or the first book without the tagline, which is relevant to how it emerged in the world, which is that she wrote the book 9 years before it was published. And there's a great line in, I think, an interview you gave, that your time at drama school helped in some ways. I think the right line was, "All that running around in a toga was great preparation for the humiliations of publishing."
By that line.
Yeah, I like that. But one of the things that struck me is that it's really easy to read a paragraph in a jacket description of, you know, after 9 years this novel was published and then it won prizes and that's fantastic. 9 years was the period you had to live yourself as the writer. I was wanting to mention that, and that just what it's like to have created this remarkably original work in your own world and to have presumably occupied this very intense private world in the writing of it, and then to not initially find that there was a place in the world for that story. And then to make the transition from that experience, which must have been very painful, to the opposite of that experience, which is this narrative finding its moment in the world and the world being able to receive it, and then sort of having to talk about it a lot and develop a persona around the writing of that book. So I'm just curious how it was for you as a writer or as a person to make that transition from being kind of out in the wilderness to being in this, you know, elevated place.
Well, I do love a bit of elevation.
Yes.
Much better up here.
I meant to be sitting down here during this interview.
It was very odd because, all of my adult life, really, I was a failure. And a lot of energy was put into, you know, living with that and trying to accept that that's what was going to be and that my life was just going to be that. And no one wants to be, you know, 27 or going into your 30s and thinking, oh shit, I'm still a failure and this is not going to get better anytime soon. But I sort of had to have a moment where I thought, well, if I am a failure and this is apparently the case, am I still a writer? And what does that mean? And so I would say I suffered the failure very badly until I started to write Lesser Bohemians. Mm-hmm. And then I just kind of put everything into that and tried. I thought Girl was not going to get published and sort of tried to make my peace with that. Mm-hmm. But of course, it's hard to write another book. And then Lesser Bohemians took me 9 years to write. So that was kind of agony as well, because you're trying to keep the weight of the failure off it. Mm-hmm. And not be influenced and not decide that, you know, you're going to write something that people are going to want as opposed to what you feel you should be writing. And then, you know, 3 years before the end of writing it, Girl was suddenly published. And then there's the weight of, oh, she'll never write another book. This is the only book she'll ever write. And so then I was trying to keep the weight of the success of it at the same time. It's like, Jesus, give me a break here. But it was odd. But the failure was then useful because I'd learned how to keep the world outside. Right. And then when the success came, it was also very important to keep the world outside.
Yeah, that's right. I can see how that skill would be useful in either circumstance.
Yeah.
And you did resist along the way certain efforts to change the book or something about marketing it differently. Is that right?
With Girl, there was... I had really nice rejection letters. I have to say, no one ever just said, bollocks, go away. It was all right. This is great. This is very, you know, risk-taking and wonderful writing. But we don't know how to sell it. This doesn't fit into anything, whatever. And, I've lost my train of thought. What were you asking me?
Well...
What was I saying?
Well, the hardened, I don't know, how you got through success and...
It was the publishing thing, yes. Yeah, yeah. And so, there was a couple of...
Oh, rejection letters.
Yeah, a couple of bastards along the way who said things like, oh, if you were to say it was a memoir, then we would maybe publish it, which is really the most vile thing to do to a writer, because you're so desperate. And I think anyone who's ever written anything they can't get published understands the utter desperation to be published, to kind of step outside the social humiliation of, oh, what do you do? And I'm a writer. And who publishes you? No one. And for years and years and years, you know. And, you know, you just carry it around. It's like a big smell all the time. And so it was, you know, that kind of thing was very cruel, if you would say that. And, of course, you can't, because obviously it's stupid, because that would ruin the end of the book. But I knew that the problem was, I sort of knew that the book was right the way it was, but I didn't know if it was any good. I kind of thought, if I change this, if I put it into grammatical language, then this will probably be easier to sell. It will also just be a work of Irish miserabilism. But what's the point? Mm-hmm. I didn't write it that way.
That's
in order
not the book.
Turn it into this other thing. And so that was kind of hard, because you know it's right, but you don't know if it's any good.
Right. It's like somebody saying, well, why don't you turn it into a screenplay? Like, well, yeah. I didn't write it as a screenplay.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Well, no one was asking that. If they had asked that, maybe I would have.
Do you think, I mean, in the you know, the fact that a publisher took it on and was able to find a way to explain this to the world or allow the world to make its own, the readers to make their own judgments, do you think that there was an aesthetic moment that changed or more of a cultural, political moment that changed, so given that there is this sort of painful abuse that's at the heart of the story? I was kind of curious what you thought about that.
Well, I think I after years of being very unlucky, hit a lucky moment. And I think that was more to do with publishing, because also it was a tiny indie press published it out of a bookshop in Norwich. So it wasn't published in Ireland. And I was kind of worried about how that response would be in Ireland, but actually it was fine. But I think there just had been this long phase in which social realism was being pushed and pushed and pushed. And there was a lot of anxiety about the digital markets opening up, and this was basically the end of days, and look what happened to the music industry, and let's just wring the last few pennies out of the reader before we all go to hell in the handcart, and we'll just keep slapping covers on that look like last year's hit, calling it something weird because that's what last year's hit sounded like, and we'll just keep pushing those out, and I think there just arrived a moment where readers just went, Jesus, you know what readers are not couch potatoes. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we are, but like not in the way we can look down on TV.
Interesting ones, right.
But you know, I think the point of readers is they are willing to put a bit of effort in. It is an active thing you do when you read. It's not sitting and letting something come to you. You go to it and you have to give something of yourself. And I think there had been just a lot of not bothering with that element for readers of giving them something they could get their teeth into. And when the book came out, I was just lucky. I think it fell into the laps of the right reviewers, and I think it just kind of gathered its own momentum because of that. So it was just bad luck, then good luck.
I love your potted history of publishing in 2 minutes. Just that
was really. I'm an expert, as you can tell.
Really, I mean, one of the things that another thing that Winterson points out in that review. That I think is really true of the experience of reading your book is that it's interactive in a sense. You and I think it's a wonderful thing as a reader to be trusted, to have your intelligence and your sensibility trusted. And I think that's what you do as a writer. You take it that the readers can follow you and can also it's interactive. There's a way in which readers are bringing their own stories into yours. And she Winterson specifically describes the fact that the way that the broken syntax invites readers to complete the sentences or to kind of create a rhythm themselves. I also want to just put in a plug for Emer's book on Audible to hear her reading the work as you just heard at the beginning of our conversation, because it's really wonderful to hear you reading it. The voices come alive. We will open up to questions from the audience in a little bit, but I have a few more. I wanted to talk about other writers for a minute. I don't think anybody probably writes about you without writing about Joyce, so I think we'll skip over him. he gets plenty of attention. It seemed to me I could hear Beckett in some of your rhythms, but I also wanted to talk about an Irish writer we mentioned last night, Edna O'Brien. I'm not sure if everybody here would know the history of Edna O'Brien's work, you know, being banned, and I just wondered what kind of influence she was on you, or how you feel about her work in relation to yours.
She's a huge influence on me. I think it was, for me, reading The Country Girls was really the first book that I read where I understood what language could do. That language could make the story different, could change within you your experience of the story. And I read it when I was about 14, when I was away from home at the Irish Language College. And at that time, it was still very like, ooh,
can you
dirty
explain,
Edna O'Brien.
Can you explain that for a moment, just because not everybody may know that? Just
which
about The Country Girls, about Edna O'Brien.
So when the book was published, so horrified were the bishops and the politicians by the suggestion that Irish womanhood may take their knickers off occasionally and enjoy what would happen after that. She was decried from altars and And her books were banned and her books were burned. And for years, she really was treated as the Scarlet Woman. And worse, because, you know, she had had this, she'd left her husband, and then she seemed to be kicking up her heels in London with all these bohemian types, and she was a disgrace, and, you know, she should be at home in the mud with all the rest of us. And she was used as a whipping boy by the Catholic Church, and humiliated and patronized. And, you know, there were loads of great writers who reviewed her work and embarrassed themselves massively with making condescending comments about how Edna O'Brien just really didn't know how to pick a man. And most horrendous, stupid, ignorant. And that would have been, you know, in the 60s and the 70s. Yeah, and that continued on. And I would have read her at the beginning of the 90s, and that was still very much the case that Edna O'Brien was owed the dirty books. So it's, you know, a source of great satisfaction to me, this kind of huge return that she's having at the moment since her memoir was published and Little Red Chairs, that she's really getting the kind of proper serious literary recognition that she deserves. And I think also last year or the year before, I was asked to write the introduction for a new edition of The Country Girls. And I read it for the first time since I had read it at 14, and I was thinking, oh God, please let this be as good as I remember this being.
Sure.
And what was interesting was it was, but the second two books were even more powerful. I thought, wow, these two are gems, and they have been completely overlooked. And really what she's writing about at that time is the way that women were just lifted out of situations which their parents considered to be unsavory and put into mental institutions. And the fear that they lived off under that, and how they had really no recourse, that if the husband or the father or the mother or the priest disapproved of what they were doing, this could happen and did happen. And, you know, I mean, I know, for instance, someone like Angela Carter was very poo-poo about Edna O'Brien and, oh, these kind of wilting female characters who live under the... But what she wasn't really understanding was when you come out of that society where you can be imprisoned for going against the social norms, you have to find other ways to get what you want. And a lot of that involves manipulation and passive aggression. And it all sounds terrible to us now, but that was the only way that women could do it. They weren't able to just get up and march out of the room and do whatever they wanted. And I think, you know, she was really writing about that experience at that time. And so I'm really, really satisfied to see her get her own back on her critics. Hooray for her. And it's, you know, it's good for all of us, I think, that she is. It's good to see it happen.
That's great. It's great to hear you talk about her, actually, and put that context, you know.
Yeah.
It's important to know who came before, you know, the people, writers who came before.
The thing is, you know, she had to walk through fire. She was the one who plowed that furrow and every other crappy metaphor I can think of. But, you know, she suffered a lot, and her life was really scarred by that experience. And my life is easier. I can write what I want because of what she went through. Mm-hmm. And that is a direct lineage. Every woman in Ireland who is writing walks through that that space that she kicked open for us and suffered for. And so it's really important that that's acknowledged.
I think that's great. And also, you know, it's hard to... Some of those realities are hard to believe. It's hard to believe she was really banned. I mean, it wasn't sort of 80 years ago. Lawrence or Ulysses. Maybe we could go back for a minute. I was hoping you might read a little section from A Girl is an Outworn Thing. The religion plays a more powerful role in the first novel than in the lesser Bohemians, which seemed to me probably a deliberate decision on some level.
It's kind of done God.
Yeah. He'd moved on.
Yeah. I don't know him already. Yeah,
he gets a lot of press. I mean, let's be honest.
He doesn't anymore.
Yeah. But this is a great section that I asked Emer if she wouldn't
mind. By special request, so blame
her.
This is towards the end of the book, and the girl is at home nursing her brother, who's now very ill. Home, knock, knock. Well now, says the man, we came to lend our support. The Ministry Missionary Fellowship. On the doorstep, but right in my eyes. Praise the Lord. Praise the Lord above. we're not Christians, you know, that way, the way you are, I say. We're Catholics. Yes, but we heard about your brother. Brother. We heard of you and know you'll want to hear the good, good news. Oh, what's it? Jesus loves you, right enough. And so, and is there some better news than that? The best news. See, the best news you will ever hear. I doubt. Don't think that's true. I think chemo worked or a miracle cure would be better even than that. Now, see, that's where you're wrong, for only Christ saves. From above, from up the clouds where heaven is, right? And the kingdom of heaven will come again. I don't think so. Sorry, afraid. Don't agree with that. That's the problem. Why he's dying. You see, the devil got in. What? In your house. Don't think that's true. Down the chimney, up the plug hole, did he? How did he get in? He's inside you. He's around you. And he'll drag you down to the pit. I well know it. And your family too. And is your father dead? I heard he was. See, see, see? No. Wages of a godless life. What do you know? Jesus loves you and wants into your life. Let him come on in if he wants to. That's the wrong attitude to take. Invite him into your heart and soul. He was whipped and bled and beat for you and all your grievous sins. Was he now? Is that so? It is. And so now, so there. Did I ask him? Did I want it? Was that ever what I said? Slice yourself up so many years ago for me, forever, for what I've done. Indeed, indeed, sharper than a serpent's tooth, thankless child. You're Jesus' child. I am not. You are. Just let him in. Off the doorstep now, I know. Enough's enough. So, you're content to let your brother die? What? For your pride and for your wrongs. He's cancer. But there's no devil here. No Satan Christ in any manner. Crucifix to bow before. Figurines to kiss now. Get out. You need to get off this step. I don't want your sort round here. Poisoned. Well, God forgive you. And he can shove it. And damn you, he will. You too, bastards. Shower of shite, attend your every waking shitting prayer. So there, so there, so there, so there. Bang the door and then that hard I'd shatter the glass. Christians, go and shite. You asked for that bit.
Good bit. It's a good bit. I have even more I could say, but I would love to hear, and I'm sure Emer would, from readers and listeners in the audience. There's a microphone there, so you have to, yeah. I think, go up to the microphone, unless you want to, do you want to holler from where you are? Yeah, I don't know, I'm willing.
Yeah.
Go ahead, try shouting. Shouting could work. Okay. I think I'll repeat the question. After you ask your question, I'll repeat it so people can hear.
And it was extraordinary. It still is. So the question is, having the drama background and so much dialogue in the selection which you were asked to read, did you consider playwriting? And it's a kind of question of the audience, you know, how do you find your form? Do you write memoir? Do you write poetry? Do you write a play?
So just to repeat the question, given your background in drama, I'm going to shorten the question. How was it that you came to write a novel in prose rather than drama? And do you, I suppose, also a follow-up, do you think about writing in other forms, or is the novel your form?
I just, because it's the best. I like it the best. I think it's the perfect form for any control freak. Because you get to choose what everyone's doing all the time and you don't have to make allowances for anyone else. I think to be a good playwright, unless you're Beckett, you generally have to have a capacity for collaboration. And I'm not sure if I possess that. I do think about it, though, and I'm a creative fellow at the Beckett Archive this year, and I have to turn in a piece of work based on something that I found in the archive in a month or so. And I'm trying to write sort of not a play, but maybe a performance piece, sort of piece for voice from that. So I am interested in that, and also how you can then strip away all the weight of everything, but I do think the novel is the best form, and I don't really care for people who say it's dying. I think it just has to change, that's all.
Hear, hear.
Beyond the form, I'm curious about the story itself. Is it something that...
Is the story... Are there many options and you have to make decisions and choose out of different stories? Or is it the story that come out and you have no control over the story itself?
Yeah, I mean, I'm very instinctive. I don't know what I'm going to write. I just, there's the kind of the impulse to write and then sitting down and seeing what happens. And certainly both of the books really came out of trying not to write about exactly what the books ended up being about. And that's, I think, quite important for me, is that conflict and having to go against myself and my desire to not write about those subjects. And then when you make yourself do something that you find intensely uncomfortable and embarrassing, and then have to write it and publish it and go and talk to people about something that you find intensely embarrassing and difficult to talk about, it's an interesting process. And I like doing things that I don't know how to do. And I don't know how to write novels, but I like making myself find out. So I feel envious. But every time I've sat down with an idea, it has immediately died. The language has immediately died because there's no challenge. I need to know what happens. So when you read both of my books, I discovered what was going to happen in those books in the same way that you do. I didn't know before how any of them would end. As I got closer and closer, the logic seemed to me to point in particular directions, and that's how they got to the end. So, yeah, it's all about instinct, I think, for me.
I think Milan Kundera had a line about writers having to surprise themselves in the course of the writing, and similarly, that if you're not also discovering and surprising yourself with your own imagination, that again, that the story will die on
yeah.
the page.
Yeah, well, I think the discomfort is really very important, to not be sure. Otherwise, why are you doing it if you already know?
Right.
Which is why I don't know if I would ever be able to write a memoir, because
mm-hmm. yeah.
I already know what happened.
You know what happened. It already happened. That's the point. In the back.
I want to thank you for your courage, your story. Your voice throughout the fifth and fourth is also one of the greatest. So thank you for that. But the question is, what helped you continue during that time? What was it inside of you that just was going to persevere and kept you going?
Well, I mean, the thing was, people often say, but you knew it would all work out. And I always have to say, I didn't know that it would all work out. And in fact, I suspected that it would not work out. And so I think there are a number of things. I think I sort of realized that even if I was going to be a failure, this was the only thing that I was any good at. And so even if I could never be published and nothing would ever happen, this was still the best option, really, for staying sane in the world, was to continue writing. And also, you know, I think there was just I'm just quite stubborn. And also, I didn't know what to do. I wasn't involved in the publishing world. I didn't know anyone. I didn't really, you know, I didn't know what one was supposed to do apart from send it out and, you know. So it was a kind of a mixture of sort of stubbornness and luck and stupidity, and it just all happily for me came together. But yeah, there was. I think continuing writing was really the thing. I think without that nothing good would ever have happened, and it was to just understand that that was the best part of myself and that was the part that had to be kept alive.
I love that corrective to people saying you knew it would always work out. I mean, there's always this sort of alarming example that I, you know, had in mind of John Kennedy O'Toole, who had a novel, A Confederacy of Dunces, and he couldn't find a publisher, and then he committed suicide. And it really didn't work out for him, except that then his mother, you bastards, publish it now, which they did. And then won the Pulitzer Prize, posthumously. Sorry, another question.
May I ask what your home family was like? They
not much. You can ask a little bit. Not too much about that.
I'm just curious if they supported you in any way. You know, morally, I'm not talking about financially, but did that help in any way, or were you really, truly on your own left to your own?
I was married to a very patient man.
Sorry?
I was married to a very patient man who was very supportive. And I think my husband was and continues to be really the thing that helped to keep it all going, ticking over. In the midst of everything, he was someone who, I don't know, I talk about him, he's dead. He's just in London. And I think that it was important to have, it's important to have someone who kind of understands what you're doing. And he is also my first reader, and he's a good first reader because he understands what I'm trying to get at, but will also say, that is shit. and will live with me not speaking to him for 2 weeks after that, before that. And so I think that it was important just to have, it's important to have someone.
And just very quickly, did you have an agent or did you just go directly to publishers?
I did have an agent. And every time I would go up, I would just think of that line from Withnell and I, four floors up of the Charing Cross Road and never a job at the top of them. I think bastard must have died. And after he sent it out. And after about a year, he stopped answering my letters. And so, but it was really good for me to have him because it was a kind of a confidence decoy because I thought, well, at least I got an agent, even if it's a shit agent who doesn't do anything. There's someone in the publishing industry thought that this was worth having a go at least. But yeah, he went pretty dormant quickly. But when he got published and I left him, I still have the claw marks on my ankles. Just satisfying.
Thank you. Oh, you know what? I can stand up.
Good idea.
Yeah. So you talked about the idea of publishers not knowing how to market your book, and particularly about how they weren't like really sure how to describe what it was. And then now, of course, I think the thing which was mentioned that's most common is calling you like the next Joyce or compared to Joyce. Was that a move that was made before or after the critical acclaim? I'm curious as to your experience with going from not having been published to then having your name associated with like from the entire 20th century.
Yeah. It's sort of a poison because, I mean, and this was odd for me when I started to send the book out. I thought, it didn't occur to me that modernism was dead. It was only later on that I discovered, apparently, modernism was dead. Joyce got all the words, Becca got all the silence, the end. And so it seemed, I was amazed. This idea that you might put a full stop in the wrong place was revolutionary. Like, this has been going on for quite some time, lads. This is not new. But I think I think particularly for Irish writers, obviously Joyce is the monster. And it's something that every Irish writer is compared to Joyce unfavorably at some point. And so it's not, I don't think it was something anyone ever brought to the table and go, oh, Joyce, because everyone's like, fuck off, you're not Joyce. How dare you? Don't talk about that. But once it got published, it was the shorthand for talking about the book, and which was very nice, and my head got enormous when those comparisons started to come out. But I quickly realized that it was also a bit of a dead end because really I'm not interested in the same thing as Joyce. I'm really interested in the opposite, that Joyce is, you know, man... as the center of the universe, expanding out into it. And for me, I'm going in the opposite direction. I want to go as far inside the human as possible. I'm not interested in linking every book ever written, every language ever spoken, every, you know, this is, you know, I'm interested in it as a reader, but as a writer, that doesn't do anything for me at all. And so there are also lots of reviews where people are going, oh, well, she says Joyce is an influence, but it's not a bit like Joyce at all. I'm like, yes, that's right. That's not a criticism that you've actually seen what the point is, but I know you're saying it in the bitchy way. So, yeah, I think it's just a thing that has become a useful way to say this is an Irish writer who is interested in language, who is interested in a different approach. I think it was really trial and error, and it was a very magpie approach. I think, as we were saying before, when I started Girl as a Half-Form Thing, about 3 weeks into it, I went to the theatre and I saw a production of a Sarah Kane play. And that was really revelatory for me. Although I had been through drama school and everything, I had never seen any Sarah Kane before. And that was the moment where I understood my own deep-rooted prejudices against the idea of female brutality and rage, and of writing those very clearly and not apologizing for them. And I was very shocked at myself that at that point I was 27 years old and I still thought that women couldn't write things like that. And I realized that that's where I wanted to go with that. And I wanted to just take that capacity for brutality and for really taking no prisoners and just say, here is the terrible thing. Look at it. Over and over and over again. And so she was very, very important for me. And really, it's still a magpie approach. I think when I came to write The Lesser Bohemians, there's a long section in the book which is written in the form of 19th century monologue, which is, you know, telling the one person sits down, tells the other person the story of their life. And that really comes out of my love for Dostoevsky and Dostoevsky's The Devils, where there's this, you know, the great sort of political novel. But Dostoevsky, being a novelist, couldn't just stop there and wrote this whole section called Stavrogin's Confession, which is where the lead character confesses that he raped a 12-year-old girl who later took her own life. And when the book came to be published, he was persuaded that for moral reasons this should be excised from the novel, and was. And it was only in the 20s, when they were going through his wife's papers, that this was found. And it's now published with the book, but it's published as a an addendum at the end. And I was always very fascinated by this, about the idea that there can be this huge thing that you know about a character, which once you know it changes everything else that you know, everything else that you have seen. And if you could just, and if you enclose it, can you take it out of the novel, and will the novel still work without it? And so, you know, so for me, that, you know, sort of Joyce and everything had gone away, but at that point I'd stopped being interested really by The Lesser Bohemians, and it was that. And then how you sort of juxtapose the modernist internal monologue with the kind of big 19th century told narrative, which is really about how people tell stories, and then how, as you, as the writer, tell that story and what language you choose and how faithful you are to who that person is in that story. How those two things work together. Do they work together? You know, and it was interesting when the book was reviewed, there were some people who really hated it and felt that it was kind of betraying the female character to allow the male character to have this monologue. And then there were other people who really loved it and thought that this was the kind of the center of the book. And I felt quite smug about that reaction. But this was quite right, that everyone should have a different feeling about it. So for me, yeah, it's a magpie approach.
And I had to say that the characters meet over reading The Devils.
Yes.
In a pub.
Well, this is, you know, also when I wrote it, I thought, because the, you know, the central theme of the book is part of this theme from The Devils. So at the outset, the first thing they talk about is Dostoevsky. So they're all having the same conversation about the same thing, but they don't know it yet. And I thought saying that he's standing reading the devils, they then talk about the devils, is kind of putting a big red circle around it going, ooh, the devils is important for this book. And then, of course, I realized no one in England reads in translation. So no one had read the devils. And so everyone missed it completely until Jacqueline Rose saw it. And then I was like, thank God for Jacqueline Rose.
I was wondering, does the theater have a big role in your life?
Thank you.
Does the theater have a big role in my life?
Yes. Well, you are physically expressive. And I was wondering if plays play a great part in how you write and how you express yourself.
Well, I think that physicalization of language is what I am really interested in, and which is why I got confused about being an actress as opposed to being a writer, was that I was always interested in how you made the language get up on its feet and appear in 3D. And so while I stopped wanting to do that as a profession, that's really what I tried to bring into the novel, is to make the language a physical experience. I want it to be bodily rather than intellectual. Everything, the way that I write is completely bound up in that early experience.
Thank you. You talked about discovering the story as you're going when you're writing. And I'm also went to theater school, and so I find when I'm writing, it's very, very character. The characters tell me everything. But I wanted to ask you in terms of your process. So do you have a big general idea about what's going to happen in the life of this character as you embark upon the journey and then the journey unfolds for you? I would assume you have to sort of know where you're going.
No.
In the end, no?
Is that I never have any idea. I mean, both novels, I started out with this, I mean, particularly Girl, I started out with a completely different idea, which is a woman walks down the road over the course of a day. Oh, that sounds a bit familiar, perhaps, but, you know, let's just see where we go. But, of course, you know, when you're actively plagiarizing Joyce, no good comes of that in the end. But, you know, that was the beginning of, that was the idea. And then the Girl as a Half-Formed Thing developed from that and became something completely different. And it was really, you know, I would get up every day and I'd write and write and write. I decided I'd write 1,000 words every day and something would happen, surely. And nothing happened and nothing happened and nothing happened. And then one day I got the first words of A Girl as a Half-Formed Thing and I just thought, that's the beginning. Mm-hmm. Everything else goes in the bin. I don't know what this is, but this is what it's going to be. And then every day was really just trying to follow the logic as I went along.
Thanks. A whole thought about the Joyce thing. Do you ever get...
Oh, I'm sorry.
Metaphor that you're Molly Bloom speaking back.
I've heard that one, all right. Jesus, lads, come on. Molly Bloom is, it's obviously, it's an important writing, and it's the first attempt by, like, it's the first time a man bothered really to make some effort into what it might be like to be a woman. And I salute him for that, but also that's not really what it's like to be inside the female body, you know? I think it's just, it's something people say, isn't it? Because that's the only woman they know in all modernism. So...
Well, it's interesting that people don't evoke Woolf more.
Really? Yeah, no, they don't at all, which is good, because I really hate Virginia Woolf.
But Winterson made also another interesting point about your work in relation to Joyce, which was that it was a bit of a slagging off Joyce to some degree, but saying that your work doesn't have the arrogance of his, that there's some way in which some of the difficulty in Ulysses feels like, you know, if you can't understand it, you're not good enough to read this, and that's not in your work.
Yeah, feeling. I mean, I think there's sort of willful obscurantism in
Joyce, better way to put it.
work that, you know, is about proving that I'm the cleverest boy who didn't go to Trinity College. And there's a lot of that sort of big dickishness that goes on with the sort of heavyweight male modernists. And for me, that's not really something I'm interested in. And you know, the point of both books is that they're written in an active vocabulary. They're not written in an intellectual, literary vocabulary. They are written in words that we use in everyday speech. And the words may be broken and changed and put together in a different way. But for anyone who is willing to sit and read and get through that first little bit of difficulty where you're thinking, what the hell has she written? Why are there 25 full stops and, you know, within one sentence? I think in time you get used to what it is, and you can, and it's available to you. You will never need a dictionary. Every word in that book, every average 12-year-old will know what that word is. Possibly should not know what that word is, but you know, it's really about concentration. There is no kind of strange intellectual life that you should have led in order to be able to understand it. Not at all.
Right, and you don't need the companion volume by your side.
No, you're never going to need any notes, and you can read it as you want. And of course, sometimes people come up with interpretations which I find outrageous. But by and large, I find it interesting that people, you know, when you just create space, you make room in the language for thought and for the reader to bring themselves to it, what they take from it. Is actually quite interesting.
I can talk last. I was going to say before the woman in the front row brought it up that you were so adept at speaking about the body and physicality, and then hearing you say that, you know, you're highly interested in how you physicalize language. Is there any, you know, topic or, I don't know, storyline or person setting that you find super challenging to physicalize with language, or conversely, is there anything that just comes to you immediately, like, yes, I know how to speak about the body, and it feels very innate?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think I should probably say, which we haven't really talked about, is that The Lesser Bohemians is about 90% sex and descriptions of
shagging. Skip over that.
So that's something I usually have to talk about quite a lot, and writing about that and why I made that decision. And I chose, when I started to write the book and I realized that a lot of the story would be told through sex, I got very Irish and very embarrassed. I'm like, oh, for God's sake, can you not write a book that doesn't involve all the shagging? And but I couldn't. And so then I had to think about why I kept returning to that. And after a while, I realized that it was about character development. It was about using the body to find a different way to learn about who these people are. And I really found that quite hard to make myself go through that process, because I did feel embarrassed and shy and uncomfortable and ignorant about it all. But it was, it just seemed to me that sex is such a huge part of life, and it's often treated in literature as something that happens over there. And maybe it's a plot device, or, you know, or it's something that people talk about after the fact. But it seems to me that in life, everything, when you write about sex, you have to write about it the way you have it. And so everything that you are, everything that you experience, everything you hope will happen, and the same for the person that you're having it with, all of that comes into the bedroom. And it influences everything that happens in there. And when it's all over and the two of you go back out into the world, you bring all of that with you too. And so sex is not something that just sits over there that occurs. It has to be integrated into who the characters are. And even when they themselves don't feel comfortable integrating their sexual selves or their sexual histories into their kind of public persona, that's also part of it. And so that was kind of how I justified writing a dirty book.
But what's amazing about there's a lot of sex in the book. There aren't very many sexual organs or descriptions of bodies. It's a very intense book about all these different ways that this couple encounter each other in bed. This sounds a bit Berkeley, but it sort of it shows how much sex is about communication, because you always have a sense of how these two characters are relating and whether they're drunk or in love or kind of irritated or angry or blocking something else out. But there isn't. It's very physical without having to involve physical descriptions on your part.
Yeah, but that was also part of it, because, you know, when you're having sex, you're not thinking, and now his penis goes into my vagina. You know, you, this is not what you're thinking about. Even if you are thinking about, like, how do we get this bit to work, bit to the left. You know, it's rare that in the moment you talk about it in technical terms. And also, when people talk about it afterwards, you don't tend to be very graphic in the way you describe a sexual encounter. You talk about what it was like and what happened generally, but you don't go for the kind of, and then this happened, and then he put his finger, you know. And so I was very conscious about how they would then talk about their sexual experience with each other. And also, when he talks about his previous sexual life, it was interesting to try and gauge what it was he would say, because he wants to tell her the truth about himself. But at the same time, he's not going to say, you know, and then I got the condom out. And then, you know, you don't talk about, that's not how you tell a lover about old lovers. And it was trying to find the right way in which you kind of get the right degree of honesty, but not too much gore.
Any other?
So we've worn them out.
We're going to end on a condom, so that's how we're going to end.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.